Summer, the best time of year, usually doesn't come with a great deal. Soaring temperatures come with soaring prices. But what if there's another way? With IKEA, your summer plans can last longer than 2 weeks of vacation and be more affordable. Here, everyone can have lounge chair access, no reservations needed. From affordable outdoor furniture to stylish accessories, we have all the essentials you need to soak up summer in style, no matter the size of your space. Start planning a better summer with IKEA. It's your outdoor dreams inside your budget.
Our guest today is the actor, musician, TV spokesman, and now podcast pioneer, Dennis Quaid, who also happens to be one of the founders of Audio Up, the producers of this podcast. His career spans nearly 5 decades in Hollywood and includes his iconic turns in films like Breaking Away, as the Mercury 7 astronaut Gordon Cooper in The Right Stuff, Jerry Lee Lewis in Great Balls of Fire, The Big Easy, and his later turns in Todd Solondz's Far From Heaven, which earned him critical acclaim, as did his roles in Traffic and on Any Given Sunday. Younger generations know him in a different light, though, with turns in The Parent Trap and, most recently, A Dog's Purpose and Dog's Journey, adaptations of the famous Bruce Cameron books about man's connection with his pets. He's been nominated for 2 Golden Globe Awards and, all told, has acted in over 102 films and television productions. His life is as rich and complicated as any person who has lived in the public eye for close to 50 years, and his longevity is testament to his ability to adapt to the always changing tides of the entertainment industry. In his current role as podcast entrepreneur, he produces the Denisance for Audio Up, along with a full slate of scripted and nonfiction podcasts and musicals. We caught up with Dennis on a warm June morning in the midst of the quarantine. His Westside Los Angeles home is high above Sunset Boulevard and is airy and modern. I'm ushered into his home studio, where he strums a guitar and sits casually on the sofa while we discuss his connection with animals, both past and present, along with his experience working with the great cowboys from the golden age of Hollywood. So without further ado, Dennis Quaid, welcome to The Pet Show. As we start the interview, lying at Dennis's feet is Peaches, his prized French bulldog. And he describes how he first picked up the dog in Branson, Missouri, as we begin the interview.
She's a peachy or peachy?
And where'd you get her from?
I got her in Arkansas.
From a breeder? Or she
from a breeder. I was in Branson, Missouri. I was the, what do they call it, the Grand Marshal of the Christmas Parade in Branson, Missouri.
That's awesome.
And I was riding on the back of a convertible, and we passed by this family that had this white miniature bulldog, and I said, I want that dog. And they said, you can't have him, but you can get one at this lady. And she had 3 more. And
did you have to go back and like to the back of Beyond, like to some holler?
No, I was doing a gig at the Mansion Theater there in Branson, and the lady brought her to the theater. And I even got pictures.
How many did she bring all?
She just brought the one, because that's, at least that's all I remember. Because
that's funny.
Well, then she also, from the same litter, her sister went to my agent.
Was that a gift to your agent? Like, here's a French bulldog?
Oh, don't we? They're expensive. But
well, yeah.
That dog was all red, in fact, so let me just see.
For this show, we interviewed Big Boy from Outkast, and he runs this Pitfall Kennels down in Atlanta, and he breeds like $3,500 purebred French bulldogs that he sells to the hip-hop community, to athletes and stuff. And
yeah,
he was telling me how the... based on their coloration and is how much they go for.
Mm-hmm. Like a blue, it will go for a lot of money, right?
Yeah, these guys are cute.
Yeah, these are miniature bulldogs, which is actually the original size. And then they bred them up. But I think they were basically bred as bed warmers.
But she's not a French bulldog.
She's a
full bulldog.
Miniature English bulldog.
Okay.
and they call them miniature, but actually that was the original size of the English Bulldog.
Wait, what's a bed warmer? So, like, would royalty keep their dogs or something, keep in the bed to keep them warm or something?
Yeah. And to warm them. But they are just, I mean, the size of them and everything are, and it gets hot.
Oh, I'm sure.
That was her at first.
Oh, my God. How could you not take that dog home?
Yeah.
They're good family dogs, too. They're like kids.
They love everybody.
That's a great picture.
Yeah.
So, according to my research, your first pet was a basset hound named Gertrude?
Yes. I had other dogs before that. We had Rex before that. But he was mostly my brother's dog because he was 4 years older, and then had a beagle named Bigelow. And he was just, you know, we lived in the city, and he was all country, dug up everything, and so weren't able to. He went to live in the country, and then my dad found Gertrude, who was already grown. She must have been like 2 years old, basset hound. I had her from the time I was 11.
So that's like the dog you had that where you first established like a real relationship with a pet.
It was just her and I, you know, like she just bonded with me. And we moved a year later to another neighborhood, you know, where I didn't know anybody or anything. So she was just my companion constantly.
Was she a howler?
She could. She could howl. She had puppies as well, which was really cool. And she had puppies twice. And
did you grow up in an animal household? Like, were your parents, like, did they surround you guys with animals? Like, were you riding horses? Like, what was your sort of relationship to animals as a child?
I just loved animals growing up. I wouldn't describe my parents as like animal lovers. I wanted to be a veterinarian. That's the first thing I wanted to be.
You were a vet's assistant at 12, right?
What's that?
You were a veterinarian's assistant at age 12?
Yes, I was. And for two summers, I was, in fact.
And where was that? That's quite an introduction to pet care and to... And just to like animal mortality, like there's a lot, must have seen a lot as a 12-year-old there.
It was there was a lot of things. I mean, I just loved doing it. You know, that was in Jacksonville, Texas. You know, dogs and cats, of course, mostly dogs, and went out to this farm to do a castration on a.
So was he like
stallion.
Was he like an agricultural vet too, and would see the people?
Go out to people's places as well. But went out there, and this really there was a stark reality of being a vet sometimes, because the farmer did not want to stay out there in the field with the horse, like for the next few hours while he recovered from the sedation that they gave him. So they gave him partial sedation, and then pulled out a pair of like cutters, like bolt cutters. That's what they look like, though it's an instrument, and cut his balls off out there in the field.
Like, what was your role in the castration?
I was just watching. And, you know, I went out there with him. It was fascinating, but tied up this leg to this leg laid the horse, you know, down in the back, and the horse got up on 2 feet. It was horrific. And
did
I almost
some kind
didn't
of noise?
Want to, I almost did. I've never heard anything like it. The screams that were coming. I've never heard a horse make noises like that.
Jesus.
And it really put me off about being a vet for quite a while with all the things that, you know, there's things you do as a vet that...
I can imagine. But your main task was like clean up and sweeping and like, what were you doing there?
You know, in the room with every animal that came in, I watched, he took buckshot out of a dog one day, 6 pieces of buckshot that I assisted on, and poor dog, I was there for and putting a dog to sleep who was really old. And that was my first encounter, like, with death, really. But he was very humane. And
did you have to, like, did it affect you watching those animals die?
Sure, of course it did. You know, affected me later on, like when my own dog, Dave.
And you see people's relationships and their, you must have seen a lot of grieving people come in and out too. Also, probably a lot of happy people as you're fixing, you're alleviating their animals' pain and whatnot.
Yeah, yeah.
Wait, so Jacksonville, was that outside of Houston or is that a totally different town?
Jacksonville, Texas. That's in East Texas.
So was this like a small town vet where people would bring in their animals and...
Well, Jacksonville is home of the tomato bowl, so it's ain't that big. And town of about, I guess, 10,000-15,000 people.
Did you grow up around the rodeo? Like, was that something you were interested
in?
Yeah,
Texas Fat Stock Show and Rodeo. It was a big deal where people rode their horses from like 50 miles out into Houston.
Did you give that a shot ever? Riding Broncos was that?
I never wanted to do that. That just seemed. Then we never grew. I never grew up around bulls. I mean, except to my grandfather's farm or whatever, and you just didn't go near them.
Right. Of course not.
Yeah.
Did you learn like how to do cattle roping tricks from when you were in Wyatt Earp?
I directed my own film called Everything That Rises, and set it in Montana. And I had a place in Montana at that time, and did it up there. I learned how to team calf rope.
Who taught you? Was there like an expert up there?
Yeah, there were some people up there, and there was all kinds of people up there. In fact, I had an arena. Shoot and stuff to be able to do that with.
Now, did you, like when you first came to Hollywood, and was it, you were Harry Dean Stanton's assistant on Missouri Breaks, right?
Yeah.
In 75?
Yeah.
So you must have come into contact with that last generation of, like, golden Hollywood cowboys. Like, they must have just been aging out. The people in the Spade Cooley script.
Absolutely,
Did you get to, like, did you cross paths with them? I mean, because obviously it sparked your interest in that era.
Yeah, I touched paths with a lot of them, beginning with the very first movie that I was on, movie set that I was on, which was the Missouri Breaks up in Montana, with Marlon Brando and Jack Nicholson, and there was a lot of horses on there, and it was the Wranglers, that I got to know.
Well, the worst thing you could do is just get your gun and you start shooting and banging around. What good would it do you? Wouldn't do a damn bit of good. They'd all leave and they'd be back by 7:30 in the morning. Now, if you want to get rid of a whole lot of evil bats, there's only one way. And the way is this. You wait till the dawn comes. About 4:30. And you're waiting outside with the barrel there. And then you close the door real quick. And all the bats are inside. And then while they're sleeping, the lovely little sweetheart, you have every one of the dirty little buggers at your mercy. And that's the only way you can do it.
Well, that's all very informative. But every horse I own is gone. And the only way you're going to get paid is if I get them back.
Oh golly. I don't hear a damn about that. Come on. Always finish the work. And I don't give a damn whether or not I get paid. And, talking about horses, I think I know the horse that you're worrying about. He wears a black hat, he's two-legged.
Shut up!
And I think I know where he stands at stud.
Shut up! You're out of control, you're through! I want you off the place, now get!
Oh, well, it is your place, sir. But the work is mine, and I'll have a say about that.
Come on now, Jed. We know when we're not wanted. Let's go out to the bat hunt now.
You lazy, no-good bastards, get back to work or I'll fire every damn one of you.
Those old Wranglers that, in fact, that's where Ben Johnson, came out of. He was a Wrangler for John Ford, and he was such a horseman that
Ford used them in shots, and then he started getting parts.
Where did these guys come from before they came to Hollywood? Like, what did they, like, how did they migrate to the pictures from being horsemen and wranglers?
They came from just about everywhere. Well, they came, a lot of them came from Oklahoma. And, you know, because a lot of the Roy Rogers came from Oklahoma, Gene Autry came from Oklahoma.
And that must have been a product of the Dust Bowl, just like them moving from there. Anyway,
just like Bakersfield is really transplants.
Part of that Oklahoma migration.
That's exactly right.
Grapes of Wrath.
Yeah, that was back in the, you know, early 30s. And so, you know, they brought their people with them and they had their relationships, and that's how that got started. But there, you know, there were others, you know, from Montana, and you know, they were making the movies down here, and they heard of, they went to see them, of course. And then they came out here looking for a job.
And by the time you met them in Missouri Breaks, these guys had an entire career, a lifetime in those pictures. They were sort of aging out.
Yes, like Ben Johnson, I was a Harry Dean Stanton. You know, those guys that really knew how to do it.
Was Harry Dean Stanton a rider? I didn't know that.
Oh, everybody rode a horse. That's what you did. You know, if you pretty much had to ride a horse during that era. I rode when I was a kid, but I still, what you put on your resume was, can you ride a horse? You always put, like, the wind.
It seems like a talent now. It's like you wouldn't see, like, someone emerging in Hollywood, some young face who's like, my horseman skills are top-notch. Mr. Yeah. Warner.
Yeah. Like U.S. Grant, General Grant. That guy had incredible skills, horse skills. Did you see that special on him?
No, I didn't see it.
Documentary?
Oh, by Ulysses Grant?
Man, he was a horseman.
No, I didn't see that.
Yeah.
I read that somewhere that you're third cousins with Gene Autry.
Yes.
Now, did you ever, I mean, again, there's like Gene Autry is in your Spade Cooley script,
Yeah, there he is.
That's incredible.
That's backstage at, in Nashville.
Now, when did he
pass? Grand Ole Opry.
When did he pass?
He passed late 90s.
So did you cross paths with him?
Yes,
like,
I did.
When you were coming
I didn't. I met him in 94 when Wyatt Earp came out. He was at the premiere for Wyatt Earp. And, you know, I'd been in town about 25 years at that time, and I didn't want to just go knock on his door. You know what I mean? I just didn't want to be
hey, I'm your cousin.
People.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm your cousin. Help me out. But he probably would have. He was, you know, he helped out my aunt and stuff like that, a couple other people. But I just didn't want to be that guy. There's my other guy.
Lab?
That's Henry. Yeah. It's Henry with about a week to live. He had cancer.
Did you do like the hot? I had a dog with cancer, and my parents did, and they did the full on chemo. I mean, it was expensive, I think. Did you try and fight the cancer, or did you just let life?
Tried to at first, but the one he had, there was nothing you could do about it. It had already, like, all throughout his body, you know, like little bumps, chest bumps.
It's so hard.
I didn't want to put him through. I wanted him to be active as much as he could.
It's so hard with pets, with, like, when a pet gets cancer or sick or something like that.
Oh.
Because you're really extending, like, if you start doing the aggressive chemotherapy,
yeah,
you're really extending the pet's life for your own sake.
Yeah.
But it's hard because you love this pet so much that you're like, I want to do anything to make this pet live. But it just becomes this weird, complicated thing, I feel like.
Yeah, I agree with you about that.
Let's get to I want to talk about Dog's Journey and Dog's Purpose in those movies a little bit.
Sure.
They were massive hits, those movies, like $200 million box office apiece.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think they connected with the audience so well? Is it just like the universal lessons of, you know, of about, you know, the relationship between a dog and a family and what it provides? What do you think made it work?
What I think really makes it work is a good dog story is always going to make you cry. When you bring in this family member into the house as a little puppy, that is going to be your kid's, pretty much guaranteed, that's going to be your kid's first experience with death, with someone who's closest to them, you know, with that relationship. And yourself, because, you know, dogs don't live that long. So it's tragic. So you have that going on, and I refer to a movie that got me, which was Old Yeller, me being a kid. And Old Yeller got...
just destroys you.
It was a heroic dog, and he wound up getting bitten some animal that he had saved. Yeah, and he was getting rabies. He got rabies, and so the boy shoots him himself. The father gives him the gun, and he shoots his own dog who had saved him. And that just tore me up.
No, Mama. There's no hope for him now, Travis. He's suffering. You know we've got to do it.
I know, Mama. He was my dog. I'll do it.
Now, that's a dog story, you know.
If you don't cry,
it's always about sacrifice. And so when a dog's purpose came along, the way I heard about it is my agent called me up on the phone. He said they're offering you this movie, A Dog's Purpose. And I didn't know the books or anything. I said, you know, what's it about? It's a good dog story. And he got three sentences in to it. And I said, you have to stop, because I'm not going to cry on the phone. But I'm talking to my agent. Just tell him, yes, I'll do it, and send me the script, and I'll do it.
So you just heard dog story, cry, can't miss, bullseye.
Yeah, well, he got three sentences into the story. And, you know, it was dogs in reincarnation, they come back. And that's the reason that it's so big, is because it introduced the element of reincarnation, so that people don't really lose their beloved ones.
They
come back, and they can come back into your life.
Do you believe in reincarnation?
I don't disbelieve in it. I mean, reincarnation happens all the time. You know, the dirt out there, and things grow out of that, you know?
We interviewed, for this show,
something eats us, and we become nutrients for...
Part
of them.
And part of the cycle. What would you like to come back as? If in a next life you'd come back as a pet or an animal of your choosing, what would you...
I'd come back as Peaches. She has it pretty damn good.
Hell yeah. She's asleep, drooling on the floor. I couldn't ask for much more myself.
Yeah. Wouldn't mind that. Or a horse in Montana.
And you had 400 acres in Montana, right?
500.
Were you like playing rancher?
I like going up there and playing rancher and stuff like that, digging wells and all the rest of the stuff that goes with it. But, you know, working the horses and all that. I'm really into horses and dogs, I would say, mostly. And horses and dogs are very similar, and they're really very opposite. They're similar in that they recognize you. They have a relation. You could have a relationship with them. And the relationship is, at first, is based on food. And a horse will look at your hand and your face, just like a dog. A dog will look at your hand before he looks at your face.
I always feel like a horse is looking into my soul. Like it's like they are looking at you in such a way that they know you, that they've nailed you.
Yeah, they're really gentle, really, really gentle creatures. There's no such thing as a mean horse. They're just very sensitive. They're like somebody in their terrible twos, you know, a toddler, which we call the terrible twos, only in a 1,200-pound animal.
If you're unsettled, they're so attuned, they have that antenna, and they become unsettled. Like, they take on your anxiety, or they take on your, you know, whatever you're feeling. I feel like they're able to read and sort of transmit that back to you.
I don't think it's like that with them. I think it's about them, because they're like a two-year-old. They're not really concerned about the way you feel or whatever. It's about learning to trust you, to protect them. The difference between a dog and a horse is that a dog is a predator. It hunts food, meat, right, to eat. And a horse is the prey animal.
Right.
So the wolves are after them, to bring them down.
Right.
Danger. You come up to a horse, you don't want to show your hand like this. That's a claw.
Right.
They right there, they'll freak out.
And that's what's hardwired in their reptilian brains is reacting to these.
And their eyes, their big eyes. It's like if I'm a horse, I can see you right now.
Right, right.
I can see you as clear as day. I know what you're doing. And everything is also, because they're big, everything is magnified as well. You know, the slightest little movements. A horse is also so sensitive, he can feel a fly land on his tail.
That's incredible.
On the hairs of his tail, he'll feel that.
So you on its back is like, I mean, that's like having a ton of, if he's feeling a fly, having like a dude on them, it must feel like a ton of bricks.
Well, they're very strong.
Yeah.
Incredibly strong, and they have no problem with that. It's the surprises that.
What's the worst you ever thrown from a horse?
I was 17 years old at my grandfather's house, little place. He had 40 acres, and he had a horse there. And when I tried the horse, he said, "Now, don't you run that horse." And so I got out in the back and said, "Okay, let's run." The reins that I had been, they were almost rotted away, and one of the reins just came off, and he just streamed out and ran right for the trees.
Right.
Got in the trees, and I'm trying to get off, and I get off on the wrong side, because it's going to get smashed by a tree there, and I tore, there's a scar still there from the barbed wire on the fence.
You got caught in the barbed wire.
Yeah.
It's like Sam Shepard and The Right Stuff when he's racing his wife.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
It's sewn up, and I got back. My grandfather said, "Told you not to run that horse."
Were you skittish on horses after that, or did you get right back on?
I got right back on because I really liked horses. I loved them, and I wanted to, I rode it every opportunity I could. But then when I got my horses, I really started becoming interested in how they think, how they tick, and really learn. Buck Brenneman, I don't know if you know who he is.
No,
he lives up in Montana. I went to a couple of his clinics and things just to learn.
He's a horse. Yeah. He's a noted equine psychologist, or he's a horse.
Yeah, he takes like wild horses, and that day he can get them to trust him.
Is that the horse whisperer? Like who the book's based on?
Yeah, that's
right.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Okay.
You know, it's about how you present yourself to them.
Has that been therapeutic for you and like in your own life in terms of figuring out that relationship, helping you with other people?
Mm-hmm. Where you can just, you know, where you can feel them. And it's about, you know, it's about predicting how they're going to react to things. Like, you know, I rode over there at Will Rogers Park because my house was right over by there, and got up over here to the left a couple of people making out in a sleeping bag about, you know, they're like 75 yards away.
Right.
I should have caught it, but you could just feel that, you know, that hair go up on the back. You can just feel that you have about that.
Right, right.
To catch it. And if you don't catch it, you've got to wait till the next time to catch something like that.
Right.
Yeah, catch them and get them under control and let them just slowly kind of learn to trust you about things. You're like their mommy.
And how does that type of work help you in your everyday life, do you think?
When you're on the horse, you're really feeling him. You take yourself out of yourself and you feel him so that you can get in sync and you can predict what he's going to do.
Once you
get that kind of relationship with a horse, then the horse will give to you.
Right,
he'll be towards you. But it takes a while to really get that kind of thing going with a horse, unless you're...
Now, you've acted probably with every type of animal known to man in your movies, and probably saw sort of the animal wrangling from... from its most unsophisticated to like where it is today, where like there's all types of controls around the animals. What was the first animal that you acted with in an acting capacity, where there was like a wrangler and you had to do a scene with an animal, so to speak?
I'm sure that would be a horse on a Western, on the Long Riders.
Right. I mean, have you done like...
That would be on the Long Riders. And those horses would be able on set. You know, the wranglers that, you know, follow the movies and stuff. Those horses know action. They know cut. They know rolling. They know a lot of things.
Have you acted with any chimps, apes, like orangutans, gorillas?
I can't remember. No, I don't think I...
There was some of the right stuff, but you wouldn't have come into contact
with them. No. Didn't act with any chimps. I always wanted a chimp when I was a kid.
They're hard. I mean, because W.C. Fields, what was his famous line? Never act with...
Kids actors. Kids are dogs. Kids are animals.
And
you upstage you.
You did two whole dog movies. What was that like acting relationship like, where like your dog is your scene partner?
In Dog's Purpose?
Yeah.
That was excellent, because it got a real relationship with the main dog, Bailey, that we had. And, you know, there was a couple of Baileys that they had, because he went through different lives.
Right.
That dog was so well trained. And it was about, sometimes the expediency of the moment was getting the dog to do something, you know, so he wouldn't have to be out there so long. Camera's over here, and I put peanut butter on my face over here.
Is that the trick, is to have some food with you so that they look at you adoringly?
Yeah, after about the fourth time, they're not going to want to do that.
Yeah. Now, there was some controversy around that movie. Like, PETA tried to like manufacture a whole thing about that dog Hercules jumping in the tank. Like, what? I mean, they wound up they had to cancel the premiere because of it, right?
It was a scam.
100%.
What happened was,
I remember reading Gavin Pallone in the Hollywood Reporter about it. It was crazy.
Right, the dog jumps in. All right, dog jumps into the water, you know, supposedly going down a river. And we didn't do that. We rigged up a pool. For one thing, the dog worked for 3 months before we did that scene. They didn't just throw him in there.
Right.
There were divers, scuba divers, three of them underneath the water. The person who took the videotape was somebody who just had an agenda to begin with.
Right.
He was there to have an agenda.
Someone from PETA to make a story because he knew this movie was going to be a big splash. He or she.
Yeah. He took the tape and did not... He waited 9 months to... If a dog was being abused, he should have taken that tape immediately.
Yeah.
But the dog was halfway across the pool and one of the trainers reached down to give the dog a rest, and he pulled him up, and it looks like he's pulling him up and choking him by the collar.
Right, right.
What it doesn't show, because the water is, you know, got, you know, right, that river rapids thing going on, is that there's a table right below the dog, so the dog can rest his feet
right
on the table. He's not just being held up.
I don't think people realize or understand the sophisticated controls that exist on a movie set now.
And the dog went down to the end of the pool, and then goes under, you know, and that's where the guy cuts.
Right.
As soon as the dog goes under. Well, there were two divers waiting for him right there. It wasn't even a second and a half that they lifted him up, put him up on the, handed him to the trainer right there on the, right there by the pool. And the dog didn't even wait to get his collar, to get a collar on. He ran back to the other side of the pool to do it again.
I mean, it was
because he loved it.
It was international news. I did a news search.
Well, that was the deal. The dog ran back to the other side to do it again because he loved to do it so much.
But that, I mean, I was surprised how much pickup it got. Like I saw you on the Today Show where like Matt Lauer was like he was grilling Fidel Castro or something. He's like, so what happened on the set?
Well, I just when I heard about it and it was just so wrong.
And
of course. Like Deborah Messing, you know, there was a thing out like that very night from Deborah Messing without her finding out any kind of facts around of it, just totally just dissing and basically, you know, calling us brutes and insensitive and, you know, abusers. No, she's not going to apologize, but PETA never apologizes. PETA was going to. They were going to protest at the premiere, and I'm not a fan of PETA. I wasn't before that either. People think that PETA saves animals. That's not what they do. PETA believes that you should not even have a dog.
Now, did Deborah Messing target you
personally? They're for animals living in their natural environment, which is fine. But a dog has been living... Dogs have been living with us for 75,000 years at least.
Yeah.
You know, dogs taught us how to hunt.
You'd have to go back to some prehistoric time. Now, did Deborah Messing target you personally?
No, she was just targeting the movie. She was, you know, the first... expert animal lover who was out there on it.
And now you were interested in having
does her, such a disservice to
you wanted to have her on the show,
not just the movie, but to just, you know, dogs period.
You wanted to have her on the show. What would you want to ask her, like if you could bring her on the show?
Well, I don't want to like tear her into her.
No, of course
like,
not.
I'd like to, you know, really have a real conversation about pets in general.
And where do you fall on the animal rights spectrum, would you say? Where on one side of the spectrum, it's like, thou shall not even hurt a fly. All animals should only exist in their wild. And the other end being, I'd really like to own a chimpanzee.
Well, for one thing,
I'm on the chimpanzee.
You're on the chimpanzee. Yeah, you'd like to own a chimpanzee.
I would love to have my own ape.
Yeah. Well, once you have children, that kind of like that kind of disappears.
It's not possible. Like, it's a totally unrealistic dream, and they're dangerous animals.
Yeah.
But I would like to live with an ape. I mean, do you
having like Tiger King, it's like it's very borderline. That's the borderline thing there, I think.
Yeah, well that's obsession.
They claim sometimes to be protecting the animals, or they're rescued.
No, that's bullshit. They're
all bullshit. They euthanize them and they breed them, and that's an unnatural relationship. But
do you believe in animal testing though? Like, do you believe in that for the sake of science, because. We need to test vaccines or whatever on animal control groups first.
They're getting closer to being able to do that without organisms. But I have to say, when it comes to the advancement of medical science, in the past, there's a lot of things we wouldn't have if it wasn't for animal testing.
That's true. And with the...
I guess I'm for that. And... while they're doing it, the treatment of the animals should be.
Yeah, their welfare should be looked at.
What I'm not for, I tell you what I really consider abuses of people who like in apartments, who have animals and they just leave them at home all day. And like a dog is social. For a dog to be alone all the time is hard on the dog's psyche because they're pack animals. It's a natural thing that they want to do. Over time, that's tough on them.
Now, do you know anybody? Because a lot of people like to buy big cats and stuff and exotic animals. I don't have a problem with exotic animals. As long as it's done in a responsible way. Mm. Do you know anybody? Like, do you know any modern day Tippi-Hedrons who have the?
I went out to Tippi-Hedrons' place actually.
You have?
Yeah, I went out. This is a long way back.
Tippi-Hedren was the star of The Birds and Melanie Griffith's mother. And the story of how she came to live with lions and the inevitable filming of the movie Roar is a fantastic story. And the movie was re-released in 2015. And the way it goes is that Hedren and her then husband, Noel Marshall, watched a pride of lions move into a house after a game warden moved out in 1969 during the filming of Satan's Harvest in Africa. She said, quote, "We were delighted with the way they adapted themselves to living there, and they were so funny." Marshall wrote a script called Lions, Lions, and More Lions based on their experience. It was retitled Roar and centered on a family's misadventures in a research park filled with lions, tigers, and other wild cats. Hedren played the lead role and co-starred with her daughter, Melanie, husband Marshall, and his own sons, Jerry and John. They attempted to rent Hollywood animals for a 9-month shoot, but upon approaching animal trainers for support, they were discouraged and nobody would rent them 30 or 40 lions, as the script required, because their natural tendency was to fight. They were encouraged to start collecting and training their own exotic beasts. Animal trainer Ron Oxley told them, quote, "To get to know about lions, you've got to live with them for a while." So they started to raise a lion cub named Neil in their Sherman Oaks house and made sure that the animals slept in their bed. There's famous pictures of this from life photographer Michael Rouget, who documented their life in 1971 and photographed the lion with the whole family outside the house, from Hedren's daughter's bed to the living room to the swimming pool. After complaints from their neighbors, Hedren and Marshall bought a ranch outside of Los Angeles in a town called Acton that would serve as the set for Roar, and they got permission there to rescue and raise several lions, tigers, Africans, elephants, and other exotic felines. Filming started in 1974. It took 5 years to complete the photography. Every scene involving lions was improvised and shot with 4, 5, sometimes 8 cameras. More than 100 people worked on the films, and as well as more than 150 untrained lions, tigers, leopards, and cheetahs. No animals were hurt, but the crazy part about this is that the entire family was just mauled by these animals. Hedren fractured a leg and also had scalp wounds when an elephant bucked her off its back while she was riding it. She was also bitten in the neck by a lion and required 38 stitches. This is all in the film. Melanie Griffith was also attacked. She got 50 stitches on her face. It was feared that she was gonna lose her eye. And then Marshall himself was attacked so many times that he got gangrene from all these cat attacks. In one of these incidents, he was clawed by a cheetah when protecting the animals during a bushfire in 1979. Anyway, this went on and on and on. It was eventually released in 1971, 10 years later, and like this became the whole focal point of their lives. The film wound up costing $17 million. It only grossed $2 million, but in 1983, Tippi-Hedren started the Roar Foundation, which was going to take care of big cats, and that became the basis of her life. And that's this crazy Tippi-Hedren story. Now, back to Dennis and meeting wolves at Tippi-Hedren's house.
Roar!
The cat's got a little extra. That's all.
Oh. Why, if you bring us here, we're just going to die.
Roar!
Do you know what your friends are probably doing to our family right now? They are eating.
Shut up.
Roar.
Whoa, whoa, whose hand is this?
She had a wolf there.
Did she still have the lions?
I got
and
in
tigers?
The cage with the wolf, and the wolf put his paws up on my shoulders, and the wolf was here.
Was it a hybrid or a pure wolf?
It was a pure wolf.
That's incredible. And were the cats still there?
I don't remember the cats. So I think she was currently without cats.
Now, I don't know too much about that story. Like what? Her husband then was making a movie about lions. Like, how did it come to be that Tippi Hedren had all these wild animals at her
house? Did she do a movie and then she got interested from there?
I don't know if she's in the birds, right?
Yeah.
And then I thought she was doing a movie with her then husband about those animals. And then she started living with them. And then they made a movie about the animals in their house that Melanie Griffith was living with basically against her will.
Yeah.
But
they were like rescues or something, weren't they?
I don't know. But they were just like in the pool and running wild.
Yeah. You know, well, it's America. I guess if you can do it, you know, I just don't want to go over to your house.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, you know, wild animals are wild animals. I was in Africa, you know, one time, one of those game preserves or whatever. This lady, she was the monkey lady, you know, out there, really 300 miles from nowhere in Africa. And this, I was wearing shorts like this, and there's a little monkey right here who, you know, I was told to watch out for. And I was just kind of sitting there.
Is it a baboon?
Just being, no, it was a little, not a spider monkey, but kind of something similar.
Right.
And that monkey looked at me like I saw that, and quick as like that, it was on my leg, bit me here.
What did you do? Did you were you medevaced out? Like did you freak out?
No,
did it break the skin?
It wasn't that. Yeah, I did, but it wasn't that huge of a deal. You know, I didn't go any more monkey cages after that. That sort of ended my chimpanzee thing. Cheetahs, spent some times with cheetahs in Africa. Like, they're very affectionate.
Was this in like a game preserve?
Yeah, yeah. It was this place that's 4 miles from nowhere that protects the cheetah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you had like a one-on-one encounter?
Oh, yeah, I got a one-on-one with a cheetah. Yeah, you know, just lay down with cheetahs. And, they're more like dogs than they are cats, in a way, kind of a cross.
How so?
Well, they're more direct with you.
Right, right.
These cats are not, they're runners and they live on the ground. They're not tree animals. Right. I don't even think they have the claws for that. And, you know, they have pads like dogs. And they just have this innate instinct to chase. So if a cheetah ever comes at you, the thing to do is just to stop, don't run, and face him. If you're facing a cheetah, he's a coward. If you turn your back and go away, he's chasing you.
Oh, no way.
Yeah.
And were these like habituated to humans, these ones that you met? Like...
Yeah.
No, this doesn't seem like a weird, deep question, but I feel like the older we get, the more lives we get to lead. And we become different, sometimes better, sometimes worse versions of ourselves, you know, just over and over again.
Yeah.
And all along the way, we have pets through all of this, and animals. Can you link certain pets, sort of past and present, to different moments in your life that were both high and low?
Oh, for sure.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, of course. I was very lonely as a young teenager, and it's very really awful, awkward time to go through. you know, everything's changing. My parents were divorced. I got the divorce, and we had moved. And so and it was Gertrude who was my companion, who really got me through that whole thing. Yeah.
And what about when you get to Hollywood and you like just like mid-80s, riding high? Was there? Did you have a pet during that time too?
I always had dogs, but it was that was when I had Dave, Dave the Wonder Dog, and he was in the dark to catch a frisbee.
What kind of dog was it?
He was a chocolate lab.
Okay.
And I called him Thunderfoot. He was just so strong and so attentive.
And you'd connect that dog with when you were coming up, and that was during that time.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And Dave went with me just about everywhere I went.
That's awesome. And what about as things got more complicated for you, and then like when you had to go to rehab and stuff like that, were there animals then that you were connected to?
Well, that was Dave too. Dave was through that whole time, yeah.
So you had one sort of unconditional dog who loved you on the way up and on the way down. That's the perfect pet relationship.
Yeah, though. He's a great dog.
Who else is in that pantheon of great dogs?
Henry was a great dog. The cheetah pictures.
Oh, my God. How old are you there? You look young.
I was 55.
And that was, you were just doing a trip to Africa then as yeah.
That's something I'll never do again.
Oh, my God.
It's a leopard.
Wait, so you're lifting a leopard. How heavy is that leopard that you're lifting?
That leopard is probably, I'd say, about 100 pounds, I would say.
Now going back to the Tiger King, did you watch Tiger King? I mean, I was obsessed with it. Who was your favorite out of all of them?
What's his name? The Tiger King.
Yeah,
because he just had the most interesting story.
It was incredible. Growing up, did you have any of those like Texas roadside zoo attractions? Like, did you have a local? Was there a local version of what Joe Exotic built growing up?
No, they had a up in Montana. They had a bear display.
Okay. Who's your favorite movie or TV dog growing up? You know, if you have your pantheon of own pets, like, but you know, from Lassie to, you know, you grew up on Lassie, obviously. So Lassie, Old Yeller to Spuds McKenzie. Like, is there? Do you have do you have other animals?
Well, I used to watch them all. Lassie, Ren 10-10 was really, I think, my favorite as a kid, because he was, you know, big. He was big and strong, and it was kind of a. It was set in the West, I think.
Was it the adventure aspect you liked?
Yeah.
What kind of animal was he? Was
he was a German Shepherd.
Okay.
Ren 10-10. Cleo, the talking Basset Hound. That's why I got Gertrude. She was a Basset Hound. Gertrude was a Basset Hound.
It was Mr. Ed, obviously.
Mr. Ed. Yeah, I watch Mr. Ed all the time.
I'm Mr. Ed.
Cleo, the talking Basset Hound. And did Cleo, this is probably before my time, did Cleo have his own show? And then what about cartoon pets? Tom and Jerry versus Deputy Dog versus...
Everybody loves Sylvester because he's so stupid.
Yeah.
Tweety, of course, Roadrunner and Coyote. I mean, all of them. Foghorn, Leghorn, you know.
I mean, Looney Tunes, that's a like classic human condition. Those are like crazy guys from the Bronx writing stories for cartoons. I was always partial to Tom and Jerry just because of the...
They don't have any dialogue.
Yeah, there's no dialogue.
They don't talk.
But there is something... If you rewatch some of the classic ones, they're really dark.
It's called The People's Choice.
Okay. And okay, so.
And the dog would talk in his mind. He'd make comments.
Who's Jackie Cooper?
Jackie Cooper was the kid in Charlie Chaplin.
Oh, no way. And then later on, he has this show about a talking dog.
Mm-hmm. That's why I wanted you to pass it on, because.
Because of Cleo?
Yeah, Cleo.
You just see basset hounds, and you're like, hey, you know, you want to start talking in a drawl.
They're really sweet.
And that's all the time we have today on The Pet Show. Deborah Messing, if you're listening to this podcast, please reach out to Dennis, as we'd love to have you on the show to continue our conversation around animal rights.
This sounds interesting.
The Pet Show is produced by Audio Up and is written and hosted by me, Jimmy Jalinek, and Dennis Quaid. Executive producers are Jared Gushtot and David Hurwitz and Dennis Quaid. Our editor is Bill Markt, and our story producer is Emma Rapold. Have a great week. We'll talk to you later.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.